lodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bass to the playhouse of fortune.
I left the rest in a phone booth, and it was this total feeling of liberation. It was like I felt like it was warm water pouring over my head, and just this total comfort, feeling like, wow, everywhere I go, I'm at home, and everywhere I go, I'm employed. You know, the universe is my employer. It's like I'm always at home, and I'm always employed. It was this intense feeling of security.
You know and I know, good horse amongst the rich ones, how oft
I... You're listening to episode 647 of Unwelcome Guests, Making the Universe Your Employer. And that was Suelo describing the moment he kicked the money habit and left his last money in a phone box and walked away from it. I'm looking forward to a world in which everyone feels that security that Daniel Suelo felt when he walked away from money. That there is a world of things to be done, a world of productive employment out there, a world in which common sense dictates that people spend time on projects that matter to them, do the things that they think are important, whether that's growing food for themselves and their families, their friends, whether it's carpentry, whether it's making radio shows or computer software, a world in which working for hours on a regular basis on projects that don't have any personal relevance, working for hours for people whom one doesn't respect on a project that means nothing, would seem like craziness. As crazy, for example, as cutting down old-growth forest, plundering the world's mineral fossil fuel resources in order to build weapons or build disposable products that were carefully engineered to stop working after a certain space of time and become toxic junk that were then buried or burnt. If the universe is our employer, such policies will not seem sensible. The sooner we reject money en masse, the sooner such folly will end. And close attention to what the universe, the living planet, actually wants, what bears fruit as a good consequence, might be more demanding than scanning a list of job opportunities, looking for the highest paid job. But of course, it will also be more rewarding and less self-destructive. Now, our main presentation this week is an interview with Charles Eisenstein, whom, if you're new to the show, you might not be very familiar with. He's followed up his magnum opus, His Hunt of Humanity, which Lynn Gehry read on the show, with another book, Sacred Economics, and he'll be drawing from both books for the 70-minute interview, which we shall hear in about half an hour. To begin with, we hear an interview with Suelo, from which that opening quote was drawn. He describes the path that led him to feel free to walk away from money. And the first male voice you hear is Mark Sundin, his biographer.
How does Daniel Suelo do this? No money, really? Like no currency, no exchange of currency?
No money, and in fact, no barter.
No barter.
For 11 years now.
No begging, no government assistance.
No panhandling, no welfare, no food stamps, no professional charities like homeless shelters in which the employees are being paid to be there.
Okay, so what about food?
Food is foraged from nature. Wild onions, watercress, mulberries, roadkill animals. And a lot of the food is taken from dumpsters and trash cans, restaurants. And a lot of food is given generously by people who he meets.
So a sort of abundance of dumpster diving.
Yes.
Okay. And he doesn't pay rent. He doesn't have a mortgage. How does he, what about shelter?
He's in a cave for much of the year in Moab, Utah. Other times of the year, he's traveling, staying with people, camping out, you know, riding the rails. And often in wintertime, people in the town of Moab, Utah will say, hey, could you come house it for me? And he'll do that because that is freely given in a cashless way.
So he does house sitting and cave dwelling, dumpster diving. What about clothing?
Gets clothing out of usually the dumpsters behind thrift stores.
Okay.
In fact, we were just down in the South Bay this week, and he got himself a new pair of jeans, perfectly good, out of the Salvation Army throwaways.
Mobility. How does he get around without filling a gas tank or paying for a bus card?
Well, in Moab, which is a relatively small town, he walks and rides his bike. And then when he wants to cross the country, he hitchhikes and he rides freight trains.
Is he suffering from any mental health problems?
You know, I'm not a doctor, but I have spent 2 years with him, and to the best of my knowledge, no, he seems very sane. And the rest of you can judge that for yourself when you meet him here tonight.
Okay, so that's our lightning round. We'll go on now to deeper questions. You mentioned giving freely. He accepts when something is given freely. And in the book, you kind of illuminate, I think you do a really good job of describing that for the Western reader using a kind of an Eastern example of a monk in a bowl. Can you talk about that, giving the opportunity?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Daniel spent some time in a Buddhist monastery in Thailand, and the Buddha himself left his privileged background and began walking around 2,500 years ago with nothing but a robe, a razor, and a bowl. And his idea was to be fed by his community. And to this day, some Buddhist monks, when they collect food in their bowl, they don't say thank you because it's not an act of charity. They say, may your generosity bring you peace. In other words, they're giving the giver an opportunity to be generous, which makes that person feel good.
So, in fact, the person giving is on some level exercising this muscle of their heart, and the person receiving is not considered in the purest sense, in the purest exchange, not considered a beggar, but considered someone who's humbling themselves or something before.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, especially in this culture, it's more blessed to give than to receive. It's very difficult, I think, for Americans to accept something. I mean, we've been giving away books on this book tour, and people say, oh, can I pay you for it? And I say, you know, the publisher agreed to give away several hundred books at libraries and churches. And people are shocked. They say, what do I have to do in exchange? So, yeah, he's accepting without obligation or guilt, and he's giving freely what he has without expectation of return.
So then where does work come in terms of the way we think of it? Like, we work, we get a salary. Yeah. And we do things with that salary.
Well, Daniel does work. In fact, he took one of the toughest jobs in America one summer, which was working on a fishing boat in Alaska. And the other deckhand made $10,000, and Daniel took nothing except the plane fare up there. Or the captain bought him the ticket, and then he was fed while he was on the boat. But other than that, he did it because he wanted to see the Aleutian Islands, and he wanted to have an adventure. Some of the other stuff he does is work, is volunteers at a women's shelter, volunteers at a community garden, and volunteers at what was called a free meal program. I don't know if you ever heard of Food Not Bombs. It was a similar program to that where people gathered together, got food from restaurants, and served a free lunch every day. And there are other ways he works which are probably not easily quantified in monetary terms, and we might get touch on those later, I guess.
So tell us the genesis of this book idea. Did you get the idea to write this book, and how did that unfold? And then when you actually met Daniel, how did your encounter go in terms of what you expected to see based on all these kinds of questions, and then what you actually found when you met Daniel?
Okay, so I had known Daniel almost 20 years ago, before he gave it money. We were working as cooks in a restaurant in Moab, Utah. I just graduated from Stanford. Daniel had been in, got a degree from Boulder in Colorado. He'd been in the Peace Corps. But we both were not interested in pursuing a more ambitious career, which is why we were cooks.
In Moab.
I was living in my car at the time. Daniel was, the next summer, he started living in the canyon for the first time. And over the years, we drifted apart, but I heard through mutual friends that he had stopped using money and was living in a cave. And I thought, okay, he's lost his mind, and it's very sad. He's gone crazy, but what other explanation is there? And, you know, he was saying money is an illusion, which I simply didn't believe, because I knew that if I had $20, I could take it down to the store and exchange this thing for food, which was not an illusion. So I didn't give it much thought. Then in 2008 or 2009, actually, another writer from Moab published a story about him in Details magazine with the headline, you know, "You think you can live without money?" That having the stock market just collapsed. Well, this guy's been doing it for 10 years. And a publisher in New York read this, and they sent an email to Daniel, because he's got a blog he writes, which he publishes free on the public library computers. And they wrote to him and said, "Do you want to write a book about your life?" And he said, "I'd be interested, but of course I couldn't accept money for it, and I would want the book to be given away for free." And Penguin was only partially interested in that idea, I guess. And so they then asked if he would be open to the idea of having another writer write a book about him. And they contacted me because I had lived in Moab. I knew them from a previous book. And they said, "Have you heard of this guy in the cave?" And I said, "Yeah, I know him. He's my friend on Facebook."
We're tight like that.
And so a book deal came together, and Daniel, of course, didn't ask to be paid. He did ask, he requested but didn't demand that books be made available to the public for free. And as I've mentioned, we did about 6 or 7 events across the country where Penguin has held that promise, so that was nice. The second part of the question was, how was meeting him different than I expected? So I went down to Moab. I sent him some emails. I said, "I'm going to be here on such and such a date." And then I got there, and I didn't hear from him, and I was waiting around. You know, I was very punctual. I was like, okay, I've been here 2 days. He hasn't responded to my email. Where is he? How can I find him? There's thousands and thousands of caves around here. I wouldn't know where to begin. And in what was one of the first of many serendipitous events that happened while I was writing this book, sitting on the porch of my friend's house, and he rides by on his bicycle. And I hadn't seen him in 10 years at that point, but I was, oh, okay, I think that's him. And I chased him down. And
wait, serendipitous? He wasn't riding over to get you?
He hadn't even got my email yet. He hadn't been to the library and checked the email. He just happened to be cruising by, and he had a bunch of...
And you saw him out the window?
I was on the porch.
On his two-wheeler.
Yeah.
Okay.
And he had a bunch of apples and oranges in the back of his bicycle in a crate. And so I brought him inside to my friend's house where I was staying. And it just so happened that my friend Melanie was absolutely addicted to eating watermelons. And she had this mysterious illness, and watermelons had cured her. She put them in a blender, and she ate them 3 times a day. And it was the fall. Watermelon season was over. She was kind of in a panic as to, how am I going to get more watermelons? Am I going to have to order them off the internet? And Daniel walks up, and he says, "Oh, don't you know about the melon patch?" And we said no, and he led us across, literally across the street, behind the neighbor's house, into a big, open field in the middle of the town of Moab. And some man who owned the land had planted hundreds of melons, anticipating that the economy was going to collapse with the election of President Obama. And when the economy and the food systems didn't collapse, he just said, "Well, I don't need these melons anyway." So Daniel had been eating them for months. And he took us over there. It was just this beautiful day. I mean, it was sunny and gorgeous, and it was like the Garden of Eden. You know, there was ripe fruit everywhere, and everything was free, and we just started picking them and eating them and having this feast, and it had this mystical, almost supernatural feeling to it. And I ended up making this the first chapter of my book, because it was just a magical moment that doesn't happen when you're when you walk around with your wallet out ready to buy food. Suddenly, Melanie needed her watermelons, and they appeared.
And he wasn't wearing a cape while he was riding that bike?
Nope, no cape.
So, do you think we should bring Daniel up now?
Yeah.
Daniel Suelo is here to join us. Welcome, Daniel Suelo.
Hello.
Okay, so my editor wanted me to ask you first, how did you get here? How did you get here? She's like wondering, how does he get around? How did he get here if he's not going to spend money to get here?
Well, actually, I rode with Mark. On his,
you accepted a ride freely.
Yeah, he was coming this way anyway, and I decided to come with him.
Now, tell us about your name. You weren't born with the name Daniel Suelo.
Yeah, my birth name is Daniel Schellebarger.
Schellebarger,
yeah. And Suelo came pretty much by accident, random. I was tree-sitting a few years back, I don't remember how many years ago, 7 or 8 years ago, in Oregon, and I had this other tree-sit name up there, and I was supposed to be officially arrested, but they didn't really know who I was because I had a different name. And then when I came down, when the tree-sit was over, some friends were introducing me to some other friends in a little cafe. And they said, oh, quick, you have to think of another name because you can't use your old name. And I just glanced up at this bumper sticker that said, all soil is sacred. And the first thing that flashed into my mind was suelo. It's soil in Spanish. So
very cool.
So there we go.
And now, Mr. Suelo, you are basically actually a caveman with a blog.
Yeah.
Tell us about that. You live in a cave. You ride your bike to the library, and you do a blog, a regular blog.
Yeah. when I first started living moneyless, maybe after the first year, I decided to do a website on living without money. I think I called it American Sadhu or something like that.
American?
Sadhu. And a sadhu is someone who is sort of like a Hindu mendicant that lives without money in India. But I had that blog just for a short time, or not a blog, a website with frequently asked questions, and I sort of felt like calling myself a sadhu was kind of pretentious, and I had a lot of ego wrapped around the website, so I decided to zap it, and I went for several years without it because I felt like it was taking my mind out of the present moment, which is the point of living this way. And then a few years later, some people they kept asking me if I was going to make a website again and a blog. So I finally gave in and did it like 4 or 5 years ago.
So you give updates on your lifestyle.
Yeah.
And you talked about living in the present moment. Tell us about that moment that's in the book where you go into a phone booth, but that's arcane now. But anyway, I think you're at a phone booth, according to the book, and you drop your last $30 there, and you walk away. You empty your wallet, you leave it there, and you walk away. That's your last money, and you haven't had money in your pockets.
Yeah. I started out in Nova Scotia with the idea that I was going to live without money, and I met this other person, Lorelei. She had the same ideas, so we were going to hitchhike down the East Coast to Virginia and not use any money. But I had this $50 in my back pocket as a security. It was my little insurance policy. And I kept finding I was feeling this anxiety. Like, what am I doing? I'm away from everybody I know, except I had Lorelei there. But I don't have any money, and I must be nuts. But I kept thinking my mind kept going toward my back pocket where that money was, and then I realized, well, I'm putting a lot of faith in this piece of paper, these pieces of paper in my back pocket. Maybe that's the problem. And I felt like, wow, I could give up enough money this far. Why can't I give up my last $50? And Also, my sister had been hounding me about a parking ticket I left in Seattle, so I sent part of it to her, and then I left the rest in a phone booth. And it was this total feeling of liberation. It was like I felt like it was warm water pouring over my head, and just this total comfort, feeling like, wow, everywhere I go, I'm at home, and everywhere I go, I'm employed. You know, the universe is my employer. It's like I'm always at home, and I'm always employed. It was this intense feeling of security.
Didn't feel crazy at all?
No. No, it felt like...
So you talked about... There's a lot of places in the journey, and maybe I'm just going to go right to one of the most dramatic places, if I may. Your book and your life, it is something of a journey, and like any good road story, you know, Thelma and Louise, they sail off that cliff, right, at the end. But right for you, it's right in the middle, and I want to get both of you guys' point of view on this, but there's this moment, I think it's 91, but there's this moment in time when Daniel, and we can go back and tell the rest of the story, but Daniel is feeling down and decides it's time to, before he's given up money, and decides it's time to end this life, you get behind the wheel of a car, you hit the gas really hard, and you sail off a cliff. Tell us the story, and what happens after your car is in mid-flight off that cliff.
Well, I was living in Boulder at the time. I just moved to Boulder from Denver. I was doing social work in Denver and going through severe clinical depression and thinking, wow, I can't see any light at the end of the tunnel. And the idea of ending it all was the first happy thought I'd had in a long time. So I remembered, like, most of my life I spent in Colorado. My dad would take us up to Mount Evans, which at that time was the highest mountain road in the world. I don't know if it still is, but I loved it up there, and then I remembered there were cliffs up there, so I decided to, one morning before sunrise, to drive up there and end it all. And I went up the road, and at first I thought, well, I could just walk up to the side of the cliff and jump off. But that was too scary. So I decided to get in my car. I know it was illogical, but... went pretty much near the summit. There's a cliff that drops off, I don't know, 500 or more feet, and there's a lake at the bottom. And it was really foggy in the morning, and I found the spot where I wanted to go off, and there were some mountain goats coming down the mountain at that time, and they just, like, appeared through the fog. And I was feeling really sad, but also, like, the whole world was really beautiful, but I was thinking, wow, this is the last time I'm going to see it. And then these goats came up to the car, and I rolled down my window, and one of them stuck his head right there at the window, and it's like we peered at each other, looked right into his black, deep eyes, and it was almost like I felt this communication with him. He's like, just total non-judgment, like he was saying, do what you got to do. And then I pounced the gas and went toward the edge, and it wasn't really in mid-flight, I don't think, but right as I was going off the edge, this thought flashed in my head. It was like a prayer or a thought, and it was like, if God has a purpose for me, then not even I can resist it. And then off I went, and then I just remember blacking out. And later on, I wake up, and I just saw red, like blood and glass. That's all I remembered. And then thinking, oh, shit, I'm still alive. And I was... Because the worst thing that I could imagine was attempting something that I felt was fail-safe. like, I wanted this to be fail-safe. I didn't want to be rescued. I didn't want it to fail. And there I was alive, and I felt angry. But I didn't feel anything physically, and I felt tired. I thought, well, there's no way I can survive this. I'm just going to drift off and go to sleep. So I just passed out, thinking I wouldn't wake up again. It was kind of a peaceful feeling. Then who knows how much longer I was there, and I woke up again, and this time it was pain all over, and the blood, and cold. I was like shivering with hypothermia, and I was still angry. But then I thought, I can't drift off again. It's just too painful, and I'm cold. And this survival instinct kicked in. And then I remember thinking, I got to get up to the road. And then I remember blacking out again. And the next thing I remembered, I was up at the side of the road. I don't remember even climbing up there. And then I remember, I don't think Mark put this in the book, but I remember this, hearing this car from above. It was early in the morning. I was thinking, why would any fool be up here this early in the morning? You know, I heard this car coming down, and I kept swinging back and forth between wanting to live and wanting to die. And then I was thinking, I felt ashamed lying there and that I wanted to die. And I thought, I hope he passes by. I don't want him, you know, I just want to die. And sure enough, he passed me by. And then all of a sudden, I just go, why the f***? Why did he do that? It's like, why? It's like, I was like, what's with these? Why would anybody pass somebody by in a pool of blood on the road? And then I was like hoping to live again. It's like, oh, man, that was my chance. And now I'm going to die up here, and I want to live. And then I started praying that somebody else would come. And then, sure enough, I heard this other car coming down from the summit. I was like, wow, what's everybody doing up here this early in the morning and in the middle of the week? And he came down, and it was a van, and he saw me there, and he put a blanket on me and said that he would go get help, and took off. And then I woke up again, and the helicopter was there and took me to the hospital in Denver. Anyway.
So you do such a brilliant job in the book of describing this, and can you take it from there and sort of explain it, how you kind of take this as, I don't know how to say it, some kind of heroic, like the turning point in a hero story or the turning point in a mythic kind of tale. Can you explain
that
a little bit?
Yeah, so it's similar to the story about the watermelons, and which seemed kind of magical, and then I heard this story and it seemed kind of miraculous. And I'd already done, you know, I had 100 pages of interviews with Daniel, single-spaced, and I'd read all these books about his philosophy. And I was trying to say, how could I convey this? Because to me, it started to seem like more than just a life story. It seemed like a myth to me. And so sure enough, I started reading about mythology, and all the pieces came together. You know, in the hero's journey, you have an unwilling hero who gets called into his adventure against his own will, sort of like Bilbo Baggins or Luke Skywalker. And that's what I felt, is that Daniel didn't want to have an adventure. He wanted to die. But someone or something prevented that from happening. And one of the elements of the hero's journey is called the supernatural aid, when things like that occur, and the hero becomes aware that there's more to life than is on the surface, that there is another dimension, a spiritual dimension maybe, that they weren't aware of. And so the hero's journey consists, according to Joseph Campbell, of the initiation, the departure, and the return. And so I saw this as kind of his initiation, and then the departure being setting out to find the meaning of life in monasteries around the world and going to the Dalai Lama and paring down all of his existence to the most bare bones. And then the return was sort of after he gave up money, maybe what he was just talking about starting this blog 5 years ago. The hero comes back and says, I've learned something and I'm willing to share it.
Wow. And so you make your way around on your bike and on foot from your different areas of Moab and such. And when people see you, what do they think? What do they say? Is there anything sort of obvious? This guy has a different lifestyle, or?
Well, the thing about Moab is it's not that big of a deal there. It's
kind of a groovy hippie town.
I should just say, when I went down to Moab to start writing this book, and I was telling people I was writing about the guy in the cave, they're like, "Oh, which one?"
Oh. Okay, well, let me put it like this. Let me change the question a little bit then. You talked about how, you know, sometimes you run into authorities. There you are, sort of living off the land, on the streets, etc. When you run into authorities and they say, "What are you doing?" What do you say to them?
Well, in Moab, the authorities leave me alone pretty much. When I'm hitchhiking, cops stop me a lot. It's like commonplace, and sometimes I get really tired of it because I feel like I'm just walking in America, and that's what I'd like to tell cops. They say, "Well, what are you doing?" I'm like, "I'm walking in America," and invariably they get taken aback by that because that's what I'm doing, and it's a free country. And Mark kind of talks about that in the book, that it resonates with cops because they're often veterans, and they're usually conservative, and they believe that this is a free country and we should be able to walk in it without harassment.
And that is not quite the end of the interview, but that's all I have. We're now going to hear from Charles Eisenstein. This is an interview from 2013 with a couple of interviewers called London Live. It's a soundtrack of a video which is available on YouTube if you'd like to watch them.
I'm Brian Rose, this is Nick Gabriel, and joining us today is Mr. Charles Eisenstein, who is a speaker and author of, most recently, Sacred Economics, which asserts that the money system has contributed to alienation, competition, among other things, some scarcity, potentially destroyed communities, and necessitates an endless growth. I want to talk more about that, but welcome, Charles.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
It's quite an ominous introduction, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, before we hear about the book, I mean, you've had quite a journey, which is our tagline for the show. I mean, you graduated from Yale, you went to Taiwan, you learned Chinese, you've come back and done some teaching at Penn State. I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about your journey, because it sounds like that's a really important part of your story, is how you got there.
Yeah, really the journey came about because I didn't kind of believe or accept or was, you know, I couldn't muster any enthusiasm for the life course that was handed to me and the world that was given to me as normal, you know, like, oh, okay, here, Charles, here's how you're supposed to proceed through the world. Like, I just wasn't excited about that. And so I kind of sporadically followed the program. Like you said, I went to Yale, you know, so at least like I followed the rules enough to get into an elite college.
Yeah, you took your SAT tests.
Yeah, I did that kind of stuff. Right. Yeah. But then, you know, everyone else was applying to grad school and law school and medical school, and I just couldn't make myself do it.
Hmm. Interesting.
And the months went by, and then I graduated with nothing to do. Like, so I went to Taiwan, and I'd been there before one time because I really didn't like college very much. So I just kind of stepped right off the boat and have done that repeatedly.
Have we just gone from one place to the next, kind of searching for the real thing or the next thing?
Yeah, I mean, I just kind of felt like this wrongness in the world that made me unable to fully participate in it.
What was your earliest memory of that?
My earliest memory of a wrongness.
Oh, of like realizing there was something wrong with the capitalist system.
I would say probably in junior high. And it wasn't like the capitalist system that I identified as the wrongness. And I still don't necessarily even really use the word capitalism very much. Mm-hmm. as a key concept. But but yeah, like in seventh and eighth grade, you know, I was in this gigantic junior high school with, and it wasn't quite like it is today, how prison-like the atmosphere is today, but there was still like just all these rules, you know, and all these passes and notes you had to have, and like the whole system I was like, really? You've got to be kidding me. This isn't supposed to be what childhood is all about.
You had that realization at 12.
Yeah.
You felt similarly about school, right? You just didn't like it.
I hated it.
Wow.
But he's one of the first people I've ever heard articulated like that. I really didn't like it for that very, very same reason.
Wow. But the weird thing is, I'm sure you were good at it because you must have been to get to Yale. So it's not like you weren't excelling at school.
Right. And even though like I was kind of a punching bag for some of the kids, like I was, you know, subject to bullying and stuff. Even so, I never really sided with authority, you know? And if some kid did like some bad thing, you know, like set off a stink bomb or something like that, like I would be secretly gleeful, you know, and hoping they would get away with it. And just wanting the whole place to just fall apart, you know, and just something in me knew that this isn't how life is supposed to be. And I wondered, and this is something I've actually asked my students, you know, when I taught briefly at university, like, what does it take? Because not a single kid or hardly anyone really believed in the system. You know, the rules are something that you avoid as best as possible. You don't really respect authority.
It's kind of a game you have to play to get from point A to point B, isn't it?
Yeah, and I thought, what would it take to turn these kids into people who think that you should respect authority? Like, what happens to them that they become the perpetrators of the very thing that they can't stand right now?
Wow. So your books are about economics, but have you thought about education system as well?
Yeah, well, my recent book's about economics. Right. The book before then was more about civilization and why all these crises are happening.
Right.
And,
the ascent of humanity.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay. Yeah. And so there was a part about education there. You know, one of the crises is in education. And
did you come to any conclusions there about education?
Well, it's just part of this program of control that comes from a really deep root. And the crisis in education and in everything else comes from that deep root. And, you know, the basic thesis of the book is that all these crises, environmental, health, educational, political, climate, energy, water, like all of these are happening at the same time for a reason. They come from the same source, and they're pushing us toward a new era.
You got to tell us what the root is.
I just call it separation.
Okay.
So you know, you look at like all the different ways that humanity is becoming more and more separate from nature, more and more separate from each other, like the breakdown in community, neighbors not knowing each other anymore, separate from our own bodies, alienated from physicality even, alienated from our feelings, all these different, and in our ideology and our thinking too, you know, where we have, you could even call it a mythology that says, what are you? What is a human being? Well, what you are is this kind of bubble of psychology floating around among other bubbles of psychology.
Just different collections of neuroses, basically.
Yeah, like in this external universe of other. You know, you're a soul encased in flesh or a mind encased in a body and separate from other minds, separate from each other, separate from the world. And that's like that answer. We think, yeah, that's what it is. That's what a human being is. But other cultures had very different answers. You know, they said that what you are is the totality of all your relationships. What you are is a microcosm of the cosmos. You know, like they had a very different answer. And our answer creates a world of control, like, and a world of competition, because all these others out there, they're not you. So at best, they're indifferent, and at worst, hostile to your interests. And the same with nature. So security, wealth, power comes from controlling, insulating, dominating.
Okay.
Yeah, you mentioned it, I think, in Sacred Economics or maybe about your own life, that you tried to let go of your quote-unquote life under control. Is it like something you think that everyone is believing their life is under control or tries to get it under control when it's really uncontrollable?
Usually it's an illusion, you know.
Yeah, it always is an illusion,
We think it's under control, but it's really not.
Someone said something recently like, climate change is out of control. I think it was like Terrence McKenna, but Terrence McKenna's like, you were never in control of the climate change, you know. Yeah. But can you talk more about control as far as whether people think their life is under control?
Sometimes I look at it through the lens of addiction, you know, which is a way to kind of control pain, I suppose. Hmm. So, you know, if you feel lousy, you know, you have a good stiff drink and you feel better, right? It works. And that's the thing about addiction, is it works. But then you feel even worse the next morning. So what do? You do what worked last time, and maybe with a little extra. You have two stiff drinks. And when that stops working, you have three or four or five. And the reason it doesn't work is that it doesn't actually address the source of what hurts. So I think that we kind of enact that pattern in a lot of different situations, not just personal, but collective as well. So, like, for example, in agriculture, the problem is, insect damage. So the solution, kill the insects. Well, then, so you use a pesticide, and it works for a while, just like that good stiff drink worked for a while. But then superbugs evolve. And so what do? Well, you use a stronger pesticide. And then that kills off larvae in the soil and depletes the soil of something. So what do? Well, add some fertilizer. And then the fertilizer kills off, some insect that eats the fungi, and now you get a fungal outbreak. What do? Well, you put a fungicide on, right? So more and more control. Mm-hmm. And each failure of control is remedied by even more. Until it stops working. And on a kind of vast, like, civilizational level, that's what's been happening. Like in the financial system, you know, using the debts are unpayable. We're drowning in debt, a debt crisis. What do? Well, you lend even more money to the countries or the people who can't pay their debts.
Can you outline kind of what your thoughts are on Sacred Economics, just to give people a feel for kind of roughly what you're saying in
sure.
that book?
Yeah, I mean, it would be hard to outline the whole thing, but
yeah, I understand.
But the basic idea is that, first, that money is really nothing but a set of agreements, or I like to say it's a story that gives, you know, value to these symbols. That it's an interpretation of symbols. Otherwise, that piece of paper or those bits in a computer, like, they don't have any value aside from our agreements.
Yeah, it's a promise to someone else to do something, and then it becomes you trading someone else's promise. And that's how it started off, isn't it?
Maybe you could say that's how it started off. But right now, it's just embedded in all kinds of social agreements about what these things mean. So the question then is, why have we created social agreements that drive us toward doing things we don't want to do and that are killing the planet? Like, why is there a lot of money in, you know, cutting down a rainforest and digging mines and exterminating the indigenous people who live there to get the rare earth minerals? There's a lot of money in that. Why is there not much money in, restoring wetlands? Why is there lots of money in doing things that we don't really want to do? Like, I don't know, being an accountant or something like that. And not much money in the things that we really want to do. Why? Because it's just an agreement. Why have we created this agreement that is the enemy of everything that's sacred to us? Mm-hmm. And what would it take to change that agreement? So that's what the book is about. It's describing what money would look like if it were aligned with the things that are becoming sacred to us, such as a healthy planet, such as fulfilling work, things like that.
What are your thoughts on that, Nick?
I was about to ask you the exact same question.
I want to start with you, and then I'll chime in.
I have so many thoughts on that. you know, part of me thinks this sounds amazing, you know, like a system that rewards people for doing work they find fulfilling and something that helps nurture the planet as opposed to destroy it. But another part of me comes back to an argument that Brian always makes, which is it's contrary to human nature. I mean, humans are, in many cases, inherently greedy and selfish and lazy. And, you know, like, I'd love to live in a world where I'd be rewarded for doing jiu-jitsu or going to a yoga class instead of whatever, but I don't, you know?
Okay, so yeah, this is one of the assumptions that I really kind of examine in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Like, are we actually inherently greedy? When does greed make sense? Well, greed makes sense in conditions of scarcity. So or when we perceive that there's scarcity.
Mm-hmm.
Greed would be insane if, say, like greed for food would be insane if there's food everywhere. Like, and I'm trying to keep this pile for myself. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not going to let you have any. And you're like, Charles, like, look at those trees. They're laden with fruit, you know, mm-hmm. like, it wouldn't make sense. Mm-hmm. So we live in a system that actually creates artificial scarcity, starting with the way that money is created, because mm-hmm. it's created as interest-bearing debt,
mm-hmm.
which means that there's always more debt than there is money.
Okay.
Right? Because money's lent into existence by banks,
mm-hmm.
basically.
Mm-hmm.
So here's $1 million, and now you owe me, the bank, $1.5 million,
mm-hmm.
and everybody is in the same situation. So the amount of money in existence is less than the amount owed. So it's systemic scarcity, and our greed and competition and selfishness is a response to that.
Okay.
Whereas in a gift economy, so I look at like what were pre-monetary economies like?
Like barter systems.
They weren't barter.
Barter
was actually really rare.
Okay.
What they were gift economies. So like, say we're a band of hunter-gatherers, and maybe you're a really effective hunter, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so
I'd like to think so.
Yeah, right? You know, you're bringing back the big kill, you know. Now, what do you do with that? Do you dry it and store it and barter with it and keep it? No, what you do is you have a huge feast and you invite everybody for miles around and you give the choicest piece to, you know, your mother-in-law. And maybe I made the arrow and I gave it to you as a gift, my brother, you know, and you give me a choice piece of meat in gratitude.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a nomadic society, especially, wealth is a burden. Like, things that you have to carry, those are a burden.
So
if you have more than you need right now, you're going to give it away.
That works with a community. I mean, that works with community. And after that, it doesn't work.
Right. But what I'm saying is that there's no greed as we know it. Because wealth comes from how much you give.
Also, you can't store food, and you can't store it forever, and it's perishable, and it has volume, which you can't transmit. But I reckon if you took that same native and said, if you got all the food, then generations to come, your family would never starve to the end of time. They might start storing up that food and freezing it.
But they already know that they already are living in a perception that their family will never starve till the end of time.
Well, because they're in the plentiful jungle.
Because they're taking care of everybody in their community, and they know that if they have a need, like maybe you break your leg or something like that, well, everyone's going to remember how generous you were, and they're going to give back to you.
Mm-hmm.
So everything we call wealth and security comes from how much you gave, not how much you have.
Yeah,
now, the question you're getting at is, how do you translate that into a modern society?
Yeah, and when it's not quantifiable and the group gets bigger than a few hundred people, then you have the disputes, and then it gets tribal, and then people are like, but I give you that arrow. Give me the whole hog.
Yeah.
And you're like, you only get a poof. And then it's like, oh, I can kill you. And,
which
I think is what Charles goes back to, and he has an interesting point, I think a very good point he makes, about how we don't have a community anymore. And I read something that you said, that you tried to create a community in your suburb. I don't know if it was near Penn State or something, and you couldn't create it, but could you claim why you couldn't create it?
Yeah, because people didn't need each other, you know? And, like, we could get together we could have, like, a party, you know, a Super Bowl party or something like that. And people would talk, you know, and they would drink and they would eat together. But there really wasn't anything to do except to eat, drink, and watch.
Right.
Right? So, like, you can do that with anybody. You don't need those people. Like, I wasn't depending on anybody to provide my food, to provide my shelter.
So it's just a gathering and everyone goes home and there's no community.
Yeah, you look around and you can say to every person, I don't need you. You know, and you could hate me and it wouldn't affect my quality of life.
Right. Yeah. And you're saying people don't want to need other people.
Right, because we're so immersed in a debt-based economy that to owe somebody something is a tremendous burden.
Hmm. What do you think of that concept of community? Just the concept in general, and I mean, trying to create a synthetic community in London, besides what we're doing with London Real, is near impossible. I have to agree with Charles. You can have people over, and it's like la la la, but afterwards, at the end of the day, you don't really need each other to survive. You don't need me to watch your kids. You don't need me to fix your roof. I don't need you to do this, you to do that. So it's this real loosely based kind of Facebook friend community.
Unless you're creating something together. Like you guys are creating the show together, or if you're in a band or something like that.
We're in a community. Right.
We are. And so, because you need each other, you're creating something. Is that what creates that?
Yeah, when a group of people are all in service to something beyond themselves, which could just be community survival, but it could also be, you know, that you're in a band or you're doing some kind of project together, creating something together, then like, you know, you get to see who you really are. You know, you can't just put up this kind of image, but your gifts are pulled forth.
That's interesting.
And you need each other. Like every person's gift contributes to what you're creating.
So, Charles, are you saying if the monetary system collapsed tomorrow, that after the initial upheaval, we would naturally congregate into these communities and all these problems would eventually solve themselves?
Well, no, partly. I wouldn't be quite that idyllic about it. Mm-hmm. Really the point of the book is how to translate these principles of gift into a context of, you know, mass division of labor,
okay,
and global coordination of human activity.
So, right? Could you give us an example of that? How you do that? Translate the idea of the gift?
Well, but first, let me just say that in addition to that, I do think also that we need to reclaim some parts of life from money, and reclaim community. And that you're right. Like when things fall apart, that tends to happen after any natural disaster. People like they, you know, it's not like the authorities' fear of riots and people stealing from each other at gunpoint. You know, what happens is people start taking care of each other.
Mm. There actually is evidence of that. Even in New Orleans after the hurricane, they actually found out that a lot of those horror stories you heard were manufactured by the police. And there was a few small bands of these rogues, but on the most part, people were like giving people, stores were opening and giving water to people, and like people were actually...
Like after Sandy Hook, like, you know, the one person on the street with a generator would invite everybody to come to his house and charge their cell phones.
That's cool.
You know, like, whereas, you know, an economist might predict that he would charge money for that, you know, and use that to control other people. But
Brian would be charging for sure.
I'd be thinking about it.
But yeah, you know, we have like a desire to give. That's so basic to human nature, simply because, I mean, you ask any, like here I am in London, you know, if I ask anybody directions, they're not going to get anything out of it by giving me directions. But they're happy to do it. Like, even, like, Londoners are not known for being, like, really friendly, right? But, oh, yeah, you know, you go down there and then you turn left. Like, they're like, that's a very tiny gift.
They're actually quite friendly. But, no, I understand what you're saying.
Yeah. And I think that, like, that's really a basic concept of the book, gratitude. That, like, here we are born into this world and we didn't earn life. We didn't earn our birth. We didn't earn our mother's birth. Feeding us, nursing us. Mm-hmm. We didn't earn the sun. We didn't earn water, you know. We didn't earn any being taken care of for all those years as children. Mm-hmm. And that experience of having received so much creates in us the desire to give in turn. And that kind of addresses your thing about, or maybe it was you, like, you know, what about greed, you know, and aren't we just lazy and stuff? Mm-hmm. And I think, no. I think that we have a desire to give. And if you're in a job where you're not giving your gifts and they're not going towards something meaningful to you, that job becomes intolerable. Mm-hmm. And a high salary can mitigate that feeling for a while. Mm-hmm. But eventually, like, no amount of money is enough to compensate for not feeling fulfilled.
Yeah, I know a guy like that.
Yeah.
You?
Get out of town, bro. I don't have this high salary.
So, I mean, you talk about this gift economy. Nick was asking about this kind of transition. I mean, how do you transition from this I don't know, you're not saying an evil capitalism, but into more of this gift economy, or what do you think we should do?
Yeah, I mean, like the transition can mean different things for different people. It doesn't necessarily mean that you stop working for money. I mean, what it means is that you say, you know, I'm here for a reason. I have something to give to the world. And even just believing that and trusting that can be a big step. Mm-hmm. Because our educational system, like a lot of what it does is it suppresses our gifts. Unless your gift happens to be for mathematics or for something that is validated by the system, you know, if your gift is for perceiving human energy fields or for empathic listening.
Or making people laugh or whatever.
Or making
it
people
is.
Laugh. Yeah. Yeah, like making people laugh, that's a good example. Like you get suppressed. You know, you get sent to the principal's office, right? So, like, you know, we grow up in a situation where our gifts are suppressed and we get into the habit of suppressing our gifts for the purpose of an external reward, grades, and then eventually money, and to avoid censure, you know, and avoid consequences, right? So even to like understand and affirm, yeah, I am a gifted person and I'm here to give something to the world that's important. Like that's already a big step. So when I'm talking about entering into the gift, that's first and foremost what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Doesn't really necessarily have anything to do with money. So it could mean like you find, you know, a way that you express your gifts and you're making lots of money. It could happen, but often it isn't because money isn't aligned with the things that we really, really care about. Mm-hmm. So for many people, stepping into the gift means some kind of financial insecurity. And that's actually kind of a principle of the gift. You know, you give and you're not sure how the return gift will come back. Yeah, but that's really what I'm talking about. You know, it's more than just economics. It's cosmology. It's a way of seeing the world.
Really we're kind of with them. I mean, you know, in a weird way, it's kind of what we're doing, you know. When Nick and I start doing the show, we're like giving this out every week, and in the weird ways, it like comes back to us through give other people giving. Like they contact us to help and give us and shoot films about us and like for free, and we're like, this is weird.
Right.
It's strange.
It's like a universal law, I guess.
Yeah, it's a universal law. You know, you give and it comes back, and you can't predict how. And I'm sure you guys didn't do this like thinking, okay, what's the best way for us to make money?
Because then it doesn't work, right? It's in, like, in a weird karmic way.
And that cuts off the kind of inner guidance, you know, which is like, how do you know what your gift is? Well, it comes back to that principle that we're beings of gift, we desire to give. And when you meet a desire, it feels good. You know, it feels good to give. And that means that this kind of good feeling, this feeling of excitement, the feeling of looking forward to waking up the next morning, you know?
You're talking about the whole Monday complex.
Yeah, and that gets back to laziness, which you were talking about. Mm-hmm. Like when you're expressing your gift, you're not lazy. Lazy is a response to being forced or coerced somehow into doing work that you don't really want to do.
That makes a lot of sense. What do you think about that, Brian?
It does make sense. It does make sense. And then I look back to like the early agrarian societies and somebody wants to play around and we got to eat or we're going to die. Unless you get your ass out into that field and make those potatoes grow, then we're dead. So, but he's being lazy if he doesn't want to do it.
But look at, there's a film, Ancient Futures, made by Helena Norberg Hodge about Ladakh, which is this region of India on the Tibetan plateau. Agrarian society and harsh climate, like 12,000 feet, you know, winter is like 7 months long. You'd think that they would be struggling for survival, but actually they basically only work 5 months a year. The rest of the time is devoted to weddings and feasts and parties and stuff. Yet they produce plentiful food, usually in surplus, with enough surplus to make beer, which they drink all winter. And even during the high season, they don't work that hard.
So you're saying farmers don't work hard? I can't believe every society had that.
I mean, there might have been some times that were where the going was tough. But overall, and hunter-gatherers even more, lived very leisurely lives. I mean, there were periods of the Middle Ages, too,